So I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you are walking through the empty hallway of your childhood home.
Oh, that's immediately creepy.
Right. It's late. Everyone else has moved out. The power has been shut off for the night. And you are just standing there in the dark.
Just total dead silence.
Exactly. And then, without any warning at all, the temperature in the room just seems to plummet. The hair on the back of your neck stands straight up.
The classic physiological response.
Yeah, your chest tightens, your breathing goes shallow. And, you know, with an absolutely terrifying, visceral certainty that someone or something is standing directly behind you.
You can, like, feel the weight of their stare.
Yes, exactly. And for centuries, across literally every culture on the planet, we have had a very specific universal vocabulary for that exact experience.
I called it a ghost.
Right. We called it a haunting. We called it the supernatural.
Which makes sense because it is an experience that completely transcends time and geography. And because it's so incredibly vivid, so physically real to the person experiencing it, I mean, the only logical conclusion for most of human history was that something from beyond the veil had stepped into our physical world.
But today, we're going to look at some newly uncovered research that proves the terrifying entity in that room isn't actually a spirit.
Not at all.
It's not a glitch in the matrix. It is actually a flawless, highly mathematical achievement of your own biology.
Which is just fascinating.
It really is. So welcome to today's deep dive. If you are someone who loves to take a massive, baffling mystery and completely dismantle it with hard science, you are in exactly the right place.
Absolutely.
Our mission today is to entirely reframe the apparitional experience. We are pulling our insights from a brilliant, paradigm-shifting theoretical paper by an independent researcher named Jason Brizard out of the Brizard Research Archive.
It's a fantastic paper.
It really is. And the framework he outlines is called the Residual Identity Echo Theory, or ARIET for short.
Right. And, you know, what makes Brizard's work so vital here is that it doesn't just mock or dismiss the people who claim to have seen a ghost.
Which happens a lot, right?
Oh, all the time. In the past, the scientific community has often just brushed these experiences off as mere lies or hoaxes or signs of severe mental illness.
Just total invalidation.
Exactly. But ARIET does something entirely different. It bridges effective neuroscience, predictive processing, and memory reconsolidation.
That's a lot of big words, but we'll unpack them.
We will. Essentially, it gives us a scientifically grounded way to study hauntings that actually honors the intense phenomenological richness of what people are feeling.
Right, while providing a deeply mechanistic explanation for why it actually happened.
Precisely.
I just love that approach. It validates the experience without validating the supernatural cause.
It says, yes, you experienced something very real, but the source isn't what you think it is.
Yeah. So to get our bearings, let's really ground ourselves in the classic scenario that Brizard uses to introduce this theory.
Okay, let's do it.
Picture a place with a notoriously heavy emotional history. It doesn't have to be your house. Think of a preserved historical battlefield at dusk.
Or maybe an abandoned tuberculosis ward in an old hospital.
Yes. Perfect.
Yeah.
The air just feels thick. Even before you see anything, your body reacts. You feel this oppressive presence.
Your nervous system is immediately reacting.
Right. Maybe you catch a fleeting shadow shifting in your peripheral vision, or you hear a localized muffled sound, like a footstep on a wooden floorboard.
Well, when you step into an environment like that, your entire nervous system is on high alert, just taking in massive amounts of sensory data.
Scanning for threats, essentially.
Exactly. And the core premise of the residual identity echo theory offers this radical new vocabulary for what happens next.
Okay, lay it on this.
Under this framework, the apparition you experience is not a deceased person lingering in the physical realm. Brizard defines these as identity-based reactivations.
Identity-based reactivations.
Yes. They're entirely internally generated simulations.
Wait, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this right out of the gate.
Sure, go ahead.
Are you saying that a haunted house isn't actually haunted by anything physical? It is literally haunted by my own brain's predictive models.
That is exactly what the framework proposes.
So my own cognitive machinery is the thing putting the ghost in the empty hallway.
Yes, your brain is doing all the heavy lifting. To understand this, we really have to connect it to the bigger picture of predictive processing.
Okay.
Historically, we thought of the human brain as a passive camera. We thought it just sat there inside the dark theater of the skull, waiting for light and sound to come in through the eyes and ears.
Right, the brain is a video recorder model.
Exactly. And we thought it simply recorded the world as it objectively existed. Which is fundamentally incorrect.
It doesn't work like that at all.
Not at all. The brain is not a passive receiver. It is a relentless, proactive prediction engine.
It's always guessing.
Constantly. It is constantly guessing what is going to happen next based on vast archives of past data. It literally hallucinates a model of reality and then uses incoming sensory data to correct the hallucination.
That is so wild to think about.
It is. So under Riot, a ghost is simply the brain forcefully projecting a simulation into your conscious awareness because the incoming environmental data absolutely demands it.
It has no choice but to project it.
Right. The brain finds a pattern in the room, matches it to a dormant memory, and projects the result back into the world.
That is wild. Just the idea that we are projecting our internal state onto an entirely empty room.
It flips the whole ghost narrative upside down.
It really does. But, you know, to have an echo, you first have to have an original sound.
That's a great point.
If the brain is generating this ghost based on a past memory, we have to go back to the exact moment the original seed was planted in the nervous system.
We do.
And according to the source material, this begins with a mechanism called effective imprinting.
Yes. And to understand effective imprinting, we have to look closely at the neurobiology of memory.
Especially during those really intense emotional moments, right?
Exactly. Because as we established, memory is not a factual video recording. When you experience something highly intense, like acute trauma, life-threatening danger, or even a moment of overwhelming, profound joy,
the brain shifts gears.
It fundamentally changes how it stores the information. It doesn't just record the objective facts of the event. It performs this highly complex action called effective imprinting.
The paper makes a very specific distinction here that I think is just fascinating.
What's that?
Brizard states that the brain doesn't just encode the facts. It encodes the complete identity state of that moment.
Yes, the identity state.
So what does an identity state actually mean in a strict biological sense?
Well, an identity state is a multidimensional snapshot. Let's say you are in a situation involving intense fear or conflict with another person.
Okay, a really bad argument or an attack.
Right, your brain doesn't just remember the color of their shirt or the exact words they said. The limbic system, particularly the amygdala, hyperactivates the hippocampus to capture a holistic impression.
It grabs everything.
Everything. It captures the person's posture. It captures the micro tension in their facial muscles.
Wow.
It records the exact cadence, pitch, and acoustic resonance of their voice. It captures their relational stance toward you.
Meaning, like, were they dominant, threatening, retreating?
Exactly.
So it's basically capturing the energy of the room.
It is capturing the physiological and psychological reality of the environment. And most importantly, it captures the physical, visceral feeling of their presence.
Just that heavy feeling of them being there.
Right. Your brain takes all of this disparate data, the visual, auditory, spatial, emotional data, and binds it together into a single cohesive neural circuit.
And that bound circuit is the effective imprint.
That is the identity state, yes.
Let's try to ground this for everyone listening.
Oh.
Think about a moment in your own life of profound, world-shattering grief, or maybe a moment of pure terror.
A car crash, a bad breakup.
Right. If you try to recall it right now, you aren't just remembering a bulleted list of events. You can feel the exact energetic stance of the people who are in the room with you.
You feel it in your body.
You really do. You remember the oppressive silence in the air or the specific way the light hit the floor? Your brain created a permanent identity impression of that person or that feeling.
It burned it in.
It is burned into your neural circuitry, not as a piece of trivia, but as an active breathing experience.
And we really have to ask the critical question here, which is, why does the brain do this?
Right, because it sounds exhausting.
It is. Why expend the massive amount of metabolic energy required to encode these incredibly complex, heavy identity states?
It all comes down to evolutionary necessity, doesn't it?
It always does.
Survival.
Precisely. High salience moments are moments that dictate life or death, deep social bonding, or severe threat.
Things the brain can't afford to forget.
Exactly. The organism requires deep encoding of these moments so it can instantly recognize and predict similar states in the future.
Okay, so give me an example of how that worked for, say, our early ancestors.
Sure. Imagine our early ancestors. If you are attacked by a predator in a specific ravine, your brain cannot afford to just remember what the predator looks like.
Because if you wait until you see it, it's already too late.
Right. That is way too slow. You need to remember the specific silence in the air right before the attack. You need to encode the spatial geometry of the rocks, the feeling of the temperature dropping, the smell of the damp earth.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Your survival depends entirely on your brain's ability to pattern match those exact atmospheric conditions if you ever encounter them again.
So it's basically an early warning system.
Exactly, an early warning system.
Your brain takes this massive, emotionally heavy file, this affective imprint, and it stores it deep in the limbic system.
Just locks it away.
And according to Brizard, these highly charged imprints don't just fade away like what you had for breakfast last Tuesday.
No, they are permanent.
They can lay dormant for years. Or even decades, perfectly preserved, just waiting in the dark architecture of your mind.
And they remain completely dormant until a highly specific set of criteria is met in the external world.
Which brings us to the crucial transition point of the whole theory.
Right.
We have these deeply encoded emotional identity states lying dormant. What exactly acts as the trigger?
What wakes them up?
Yeah. Why do they suddenly wake up on a random Tuesday? Years later.
The answer lies in the concept of environmental resonance.
Environmental resonance, right?
Yeah.
Because people don't just walk around seeing ghosts 24/7.
Usually not, no.
Usually happens in very specific places. Yeah. So the brain has locked this trauma into a high-res dormant file. What acts as the trigger warning to rip that file open?
Well, the Brizard Archive details this concept of contextual resonance.
Okay, break that down for us.
Basically, certain environments contain sensory or structural features that partially match the original conditions of the dormant affective imprint.
So the environment is the key.
The environment is everything. Let's look at the locations where apparitional experiences classically cluster. Old hospitals, historic battlefields, childhood homes, sites of intense trauma or tragedy.
Places that just have a vibe.
Right. We often think these places are haunted because bad things happen there.
Sure, that's the classic ghost story lore.
But from a biological perspective, these locations possess very strong, highly specific sensory cues that are universally resonant with human anxiety and trauma.
Okay, like what kind of cues are we talking about?
Well, it could be the specific spatial geometry of a long, narrow hallway that limits your escape routes.
Oh, that claustrophobic feeling.
Yes. It could be the exact angle that light filters through a dust-covered window, creating high-contrast shadows.
Creepy lighting.
Right. It could be a particular damp smell in the air, a drop in barometric pressure, or even just a heavy, oppressive, unnatural silence.
I mean, you've definitely experienced this. Anyone listening has. You walk into a room, maybe it's the basement of an antique store or the attic of an old relative's house, and instantly, before you even have a conscious thought, a heavy, suffocating mood just drops over you.
You feel it in your gut.
Yeah. The room is completely empty. Nothing bad is happening. But you suddenly feel deeply anxious or overwhelmingly sad.
And what you are feeling there is your brain detecting environmental resonance.
It's running a background process.
Constantly. As you walk through the world, your brain is constantly invisibly scanning the room you were standing in.
Wow.
And when it finds a structural or sensory match to one of those dormant emotional imprints we talked about, it rings an alarm bell deep in your subconscious.
And what happens when that alarm goes off?
When that alarm bell rings, the brain engages its pattern matching system. In neurobiology, this involves vast networks of synaptic firing.
So the brain goes into overdrive.
We can think of it as a principle of match and amplify.
Match and amplify.
Yes. The brain detects these partial environmental matches, you know, the lighting, the geometry, the isolation, and it begins to actively amplify them in your conscious awareness.
So it's basically building a bridge.
Yes, exactly. What Brizard calls a neurocomputational bridge.
I like that term.
Sensory cortices, which are the parts of your brain processing the sight and sound of the room, they begin passing urgent signals to the limbic system, where the emotional memory is stored.
Trying to connect the dots.
Right. It operates on Hebbian learning principles.
Remind us what that is.
Neurons that fire together wire together.
Yes.
So the physical room you are currently standing in becomes structurally linked to the dormant emotional memory inside you.
Okay, I want to use an analogy here, because this is a lot of complex neurobiology.
Sure, analogies help.
It sounds like the environment acts like a tuning fork. You walk into the old hospital, and the geometry of the room vibrates at a specific frequency.
Okay.
And somewhere deep in your brain, that dormant memory catches the vibration and starts humming along with it.
I like the tuning fork analogy, but let's actually push it a bit further to capture the sheer complexity of the brain.
Oh, all right. Let's hear it.
It is not just a single tuning fork. Imagine your brain is a room filled with thousands of perfectly pitched, delicate crystal glasses.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Each glass represents a different, deeply encoded emotional memory. When you walk into a resonant environment, the environment doesn't just vibrate broadly.
Right.
It hits the exact acoustic frequency required to make one specific glass in that room start to aggressively hum.
Oh, wow.
Vibrating so hard it's on the absolute verge of shattering. The environment shatters the boundary between past and present.
That is terrifying and beautiful at the same time.
It is an incredible mechanism.
But the brain can't just let two conflicting realities exist simultaneously, right?
Well,
I mean, you are standing in an empty room in 2026, but your limbic system is screaming that you are back in a traumatic moment from 1998.
Right. There's a massive cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. So once that neurocomputational bridge is built and the humming of that crystal glass hits a critical threshold, the brain is forced to resolve the incoming data.
It has to.
It has to make sense of why the current environment is vibrating with the exact same frequency as a highly charged emotional memory.
And this is the threshold where the phenomenon completely transforms.
This is the ghost part.
This is where the literal multisensory ghost actually appears in the room.
So let's get into the grand finale of the haunting, the third major mechanism in Brizard's paper, identity reactivation and cross-modal reinforcement.
Yes. The threshold of reactivation is perhaps the most critical concept in all of Riot.
Okay, why is that?
Well, we mentioned earlier that memories are usually passive, right? You recall them, you look at them, and you put them away.
Like looking at a photo album.
Exactly. Mm. But when the environmental resonance crosses a specific intensity threshold, the brain doesn't just lazily remember the past.
It doesn't just pull out the photo album.
No. At this threshold, the brain reactivates the encoded identity state. It pulls it completely out of storage and runs it as an active, predictive simulation in the present moment.
Okay, hold on. This is where I really have to play devil's advocate because I'm having a hard time buying this specific leap.
That's fair. A lot of people do.
I completely buy the emotional resonance part.
Mm.
I understand why a creepy hallway makes me feel anxious or brings up an old feeling of dread based on my past.
Sure.
But you are leaping from, you know, feeling sad and scared in an old house to seeing a translucent Victorian woman in a nightgown standing in the corner.
Yes.
That is a massive, massive leap.
Yeah.
If my brain is doing this, how does a subconscious memory physically paint a hallucination into my visual field?
That's a great question.
And why does it feel so entirely external? Like, if I'm doing the CGI work, shouldn't I know I'm generating it?
That is the perfect question to ask, and it gets to the absolute core of why hauntings are so universally misunderstood.
So explain it to me. Make me a believer in the biology.
Okay, to answer your first point, why does it feel external? It feels external because this reactivation is an automatic predictive response. It is not a deliberate, conscious act of imagination.
It's like a reflex.
Exactly like a reflex. You didn't consciously decide to sit down and daydream about a ghost. The predictive processing networks in your autonomic nervous system executed the simulation entirely beneath the level of your conscious control.
So my conscious brain is just along for the ride.
Right. Because your conscious self did not author the thought. Your cognitive system misattributes the source.
It thinks someone else did it.
Yes. It interprets the simulation as an external autonomous presence. It feels like it is happening to you rather than being generated by you.
That is so weird.
Well, it is no different than dreaming, really. Mm-hmm. When you dream, your brain generates the entire world, every detail, yet you feel like a passive participant inside it.
You feel like you're just walking through a place someone else built? Okay, that makes sense for the feeling of a presence. But it still doesn't explain the visual hallucination.
Right, the actual apparition.
Yeah, people report seeing full body apparitions, hearing distinct footsteps, feeling an actual freezing hand on their shoulder.
And that is where cross-modal reinforcement comes in.
Cross-modal reinforcement.
Yes. This is the mechanism that generates the hallucination. It stems from a fundamental rule of neuroscience. The human brain absolutely abhors a vacuum.
It hates missing information.
It hates missing information.
Because missing information in the wild means you might get eaten by something you didn't see.
Precisely.
What?
If your limbic system is screaming that there is a threat because the environment resonates deeply with a dormant identity state, your brain's predictive engine calculates a massive statistical probability that the threat is physically in the room with you.
It assumes the threat is real and present.
Right. The amygdala says we are in danger. But the visual cortex is saying, I don't see anything.
So it's a conflict.
A massive conflict. The brain cannot tolerate this contradiction. And because the brain is an active generator of reality, it will literally fill in the sensory blanks to force the world to match its prediction.
Wait. So if it can't find the threat, it just draws the threat.
Yes. It recruits the sensory cortices to fabricate the data.
That is insane.
We see this in other neurological conditions, actually.
Like what?
Think of phantom limb syndrome, where a person vividly feels pain in an arm that has been amputated.
Oh, right, because the brain still expects it to be there.
Exactly. The brain expects the arm to be there, so it generates the sensory feeling of the arm.
Wow.
Or consider Charles Bonnet syndrome, where people with vision loss begin experiencing vivid, complex visual hallucinations.
Really? Just out of nowhere?
Yes. Because the brain isn't receiving visual input, so it aggressively generates its own.
So the brain is cross-modally reinforcing the affective memory.
That's exactly it.
The emotional resonance is so intense that the visual, auditory, and tactile centers of the brain are hijacked.
They are forced to comply with the emotional reality.
Right. They are forced to build a coherent, multisensory reality that justifies the intense feeling of dread. It hallucinates a physical reality to match the emotional reality.
Yes. The brain is basically performing a massive instantaneous computation.
It's doing math.
It is. It says, I feel an overwhelming sense of dread, and the energetic signature matches the presence of a threatening figure from my past.
Right.
Therefore, there must be a threatening figure in the corner right now. I will construct a visual and auditory model of a figure in the corner so that this physiological panic makes logical sense.
So it isn't crazy, it's actually hyperlogical.
Exactly. Though the sheer computational power required to fabricate footsteps, shifting shadows, and localized temperature drops in real time is staggering.
It is unbelievable. The brain is basically functioning as a real-time Hollywood rendering farm just to keep your internal narrative consistent.
That's a great way to put it.
To perfectly visualize how this entire sequence operates from start to finish. Brizard provides a truly brilliant analogy in the source material.
Yes, the Bell analogy.
He explicitly calls it the Bell analogy, and it lays out the architecture of this echo perfectly.
The Bell analogy is highly effective because it synthesizes all this complex, dense neurobiology we've been discussing into a very tangible physical concept that anyone can grasp.
I love a good analogy, so let's walk through it.
Sure.
I want you to imagine that a deeply encoded identity state, that emotional memory we've been talking about, is a heavy cast iron bell hanging in the center of your mind.
Okay, so we have the bell.
Right. First, you have the strike.
The strike.
This is the original emotional event. The violent car crash, the bitter argument, the moment of profound world-altering loss. The hammer physically strikes the bell.
That's the trauma being encoded.
Exactly. Next, you have the vibration. This is the dormant memory trace left behind. The bell isn't ringing out loud anymore. You can't hear it.
But it's not totally still either.
Right. If you walk up and touch the metal, you can feel it microvibrating. It is holding on to the kinetic energy of that original strike for years, sometimes decades.
Okay, so the bell is holding the charge.
Then you have the room. This is your current environment. The geometry of the hallway, the lighting, the temperature, the isolation.
The creepy hospital or the basement?
Yes. The physical room acts as an acoustic chamber. Depending on its shape and sensory inputs, it can either dampen the sound or it can amplify it.
Which is the environmental resonance.
Exactly. And finally, you have the echo. This is the apparition itself.
Mm.
The ghost.
The ghost. And the crucial takeaway from this analogy, and really the core of Brizard's entire thesis, is that the echo is not the original strike.
Right.
It is a resonant reactivation. A haunted room is not magically filled with lingering spirits.
No supernatural stuff.
No. It is simply a physical context, an acoustic chamber that possesses the exact right dimensions and sensory cues to make the dormant bell inside your own mind ring again.
Wow.
The ghost is just the echo of your own encoded history bouncing off the walls of the present moment.
A haunted room is just a context that makes the bell ring again. That is such a hauntingly beautiful way to look at it. It genuinely gives me chills.
It's very poetic for a scientific paper.
It is. But Brizard doesn't just stop at Riot. This is where the deep dive gets even more fascinating, because the Brizard archive goes so much further.
He really builds out a whole system.
He does. He integrates this specific ghost-generating mechanism into a massive, overarching architecture of human cognition.
Indeed, he does. If we zoom out and broaden the scope, we can see that the residual identity echo theory is not just some isolated fringe theory about ghosts.
It's not a one-off idea.
No, it fits perfectly as a specialized layer within Brizard's much larger cognitive system. When we look at a haunting through the lens of the full archive, a ghost sighting isn't a neurological glitch.
It isn't a breakdown of sanity.
Exactly. It is actually a symphony of highly evolved cognitive frameworks working together in perfect, terrifying harmony.
A symphony. I love that.
To really understand the sheer mechanics of it, we need to trace the apparition through the five core pillars of Brizard's architecture.
And this is where we really get to look under the hood of human perception. Let's trace the signal from the exact moment you step into the room to the moment you run out screaming.
Okay, let's trace it.
It starts at the very base layer with something Brizard calls PFT, or perceptual framing theory.
Yes. PFT is the foundation. It is responsible for constructing the initial frame of your conscious experience.
Setting the mood.
Right. Let's go back to our scenario. You walk into the abandoned hospital ward. Before you feel a ghost, PFT is at work.
What's it doing?
The brain's reticular activating system is filtering millions of bits of sensory data. PFT extracts the perceptual anchors.
Like the peeling paint on the walls.
The peeling paint, the dim, flickering lighting, the unnatural silence. It sets the overarching interpretive narrative.
Which in this case is. This place is creepy, unpredictable, and potentially dangerous.
Exactly.
So PFT acts like a spotlight. It filters out the mundane stuff like the dust on the floor and hyper-focuses your attention on the spooky or resonant cues.
It sets the stage for the haunting.
Okay, so the stage is set. Once the stage is set, the signal moves into the second pillar, TFL, or the temporal feedback loop.
Right. If PFT is the stage, TFL is the engine of time and memory.
The engine.
Once PFT frames the environment as highly resonant and potentially threatening, the temporal feedback loop activates. This involves the working memory buffering against long-term storage in the hippocampus.
So it's digging through the archives.
Yes. TFL reaches back into your stored memory networks. It locates that dormant, emotionally encoded identity state, the vibrating bell we talked about.
Okay.
And it actively pulls it forward, feeding it directly into your present conscious awareness.
It literally drags the past into the now.
Yes, it forces a collision.
It forces a collision between what happened 10 years ago and what is happening right this second. Okay, so now we have the environment framed and the memory pulled forward.
Correct.
Next, we hit the third pillar, SST, or simulation synchronization theory. This is where identity gets involved, right?
This is where it gets highly personal.
How so?
Well, SST governs how you model yourself and others in social spaces. It relies heavily on theory of mind and mirror neuron networks.
Okay, so how we relate to people.
Exactly. When TFL pulls that past identity state into the present, SST tries to synchronize it with how you currently feel in the room. It shapes your interpretation of the echo.
So give me an example of how SST shapes the ghost. What does it actually do?
Let's say you walk into that hospital feeling incredibly vulnerable and alone.
Pretty common in that setting.
Right. SST takes the raw emotional memory that TFL pulled up, and it synchronizes it as a dominant, threatening external presence.
It makes it fit your vulnerability.
Yes. It projects an identity that perfectly counters your current emotional state. It turns a raw, formless memory into an interactive other.
Oh, wow.
It assigns motives and agency to the hallucination. This is why the ghost feels like it is watching you or judging you or threatening you. SST is projecting an identity onto the echo.
So it gives the ghost a personality that perfectly exploits your current emotional vulnerabilities.
It custom builds your nightmare.
That is just diabolical. So now you have a fully formed, threatening entity in the room with you. The system obviously demands a response to this threat, which triggers the fourth pillar, IRE. The intent resolution engine.
Yes. IRE is the volitional arbitrator.
The decision maker.
Right. It operates heavily in the basal ganglia, making split-second decisions about action. You are now consciously perceiving a threatening presence.
The ghost is there.
IRE evaluates the competing vectors of intention. What do you do? Do you freeze in place? Do you turn and run away in absolute terror?
Or, I mean, depending on the emotional resonance, do you try to communicate and feel a meaningful connection with the entity?
Exactly. Eyrie calculates the effective charge, the urgency of the threat, and the contextual fit of the environment and forces your body to execute a single decisive physical action.
It's the ultimate fight, flight, or freeze switchboard. Run, stay, or speak.
Yes, it forces a resolution.
And finally, overarching all of this, the thing that keeps this entire terrifying, hallucinatory experience glued together so it feels real, is the fifth pillar. TCRF, the Temporal Coherence Resonance Framework.
TCRF is perhaps the most fascinating piece of the entire puzzle.
Tell me why.
It acts as the clocking layer of consciousness. Without TCRF, this entire memory reactivation process would just be a chaotic microsecond flash of panic.
Like a glitch.
Yes. It would feel like a brief neurological glitch, a sudden shiver, and then it would just be over. But TCRF continually aligns the incoming predictive simulations with your immediate past, maintaining temporal resonance.
So what does that mean in terms of the actual experience? How does TCRF change what I see?
It creates the persistence of the hallucination.
It makes it last.
Exactly. It manages the frame rates of your consciousness. It ensures that the apparition doesn't just flash and disappear, but that it moves smoothly across the room.
It animates it.
Right. It ensures that if the brain hallucinates a voice, the voice forms coherent words over several continuous seconds. TCRF bridges the gaps between the predictive updates,
turning a millisecond biological misfire into a seamless, continuous, and utterly terrifying narrative experience of seeing a ghost.
Yes, it is the glue of the hallucination.
It's the director of the movie. So what does this all mean when we put it together? When you stack perceptual framing, the temporal feedback loop, simulation synchronization, the intent resolution engine, and the temporal coherence framework, all on top of the residual identity echo theory.
That's a huge stack.
It is. But it means that seeing a ghost is absolutely not proof that you are losing your mind or going crazy.
Far from it.
It is actually proof that your neurocognitive machinery is executing a flawlessly synchronized, highly advanced, deeply complex loop of memory, perception, and prediction.
Your brain is functioning at peak capacity.
Right. Your brain is doing exactly what millions of years of rigorous evolution designed it to do. It is pattern matching for your survival, analyzing the environment for invisible threats, and aggressively filling in the blanks to keep you alive.
It is a stunning testament to the absolute power of the human brain as a reality-generating engine.
It really is.
We are not just recording the world as it is. We are actively projecting our internal state onto it. We are using the physical environment as a blank canvas.
And painting it.
Painting it with our deepest, most heavily encoded emotional imprints.
And that brings us to the ultimate takeaway of today's deep dive. We have taken the supernatural, the paranormal, the things that go bump in the night and terrify us in the dark, and we have grounded them in the beautiful, complex, and sometimes devastating mechanics of human biology.
Science doesn't ruin the magic. It explains it.
Exactly. Hauntings are a testament to the absolute persistence of our emotions. They prove that our feelings and our traumas don't just fade away into the ether. They leave permanent structural, physical imprints in the architecture of our minds.
They shape who we are.
And they showcase the incredible hallucinatory power of our brain's predictive engine to conjure reality completely out of thin air.
And, you know, if we connect this biological reality to the bigger picture of how we live our lives, it highlights a profound, almost philosophical truth about human existence.
Which is?
We are never just passive observers of our environment. We do not walk through an empty, objective world. We are constantly, relentlessly painting our surroundings with the emotional echoes of our past.
We project everything.
Every single room we enter, every environment we experience is colored and shaped by the dormant bells we carry inside us.
Which leaves us with a final, lingering, and honestly somewhat provocative question for you to explore on your own.
I like where this is going.
We've spent this entire time talking about how the brain generates literal ghosts in empty rooms just to satisfy a predictive model based on past trauma. But think about your daily mundane life. Think about the people you interact with.
Living, breathing people.
Right. If our brains are capable of generating such vivid, multi-sensory, interactive ghosts based purely on resonant environments and past emotional imprints, how much of the living, breathing people we interact with every single day are actually just resonant echoes we are projecting onto them?
Oh, man. That forces us to question our entire social reality.
Exactly. When you are arguing with your partner, when you are intimidated by your boss, or when you feel instant friction with a total stranger, are you actually seeing them for who they truly are?
Or is your brain just detecting a structural resonance?
ringing an old emotional bell and projecting a predictive simulation built entirely from the ghosts of your own past.
How often are you talking to the person in front of you, and how often are you just arguing with an echo?
A deeply fascinating and wildly unsettling thought. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the reality your brain is building for you, because sometimes the terrifying ghost in the room is just the echo of your own mind trying to tell you something you forgot.